afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the FCC luncheon today. Thank you so much. I'm Angie Lau. I'm your host for today. I'm a correspondent board member here at the FCC. I'm also anchor at Bloomberg, and I'm joined by Keith Bradshaw, New York Times correspondent, and Florence de Changy, also a fellow correspondent board member, and a wonderful writer at that. Just a few pieces of housekeeping. If you own one of these, please put it on silent mode or turn it off. I don't want to take it away from you. And auction it off at the highest bid. And I also want to bring attention that, of course, thank you so much for your support at these wonderful luncheons and events that we do here. The next one is one that I'll also be hosting, and it's going to be certainly one for the history books, we hope. It is the FCC Debate Challenge rematch. Now, last year, if any of you attended, the students of the Hong Kong School's Debating Club, well, they beat us. Yeah, it's time for us to take that trophy back. So we do hope that you'll support us in that venture. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. He is Professor Madhav Nalapat. He's also UNESCO Peace Chair at Manipal University. But he tells us about a new India today. And in fact, back in 2006, after following Narendra Modi as an academic, and following his policies for the past 16 years, back in 2006, Professor Nalapat was the first to predict that Modi will become Prime Minister of India within 10 years. And you were right, within 10 years, we'll give it to you. We'll give it to you. But of course, the challenges are great. And let's hear from Professor Nalapat on the Modi model, a break from India's past.
Thank you very much. The good news is that you got a splendid lunch, so you're not going to be paying too much attention to what I say. So I'm delighted about that. I just want to say that, now we have a new prime minister. And for some of us, it's important because Mr. Modi represents a complete break from an India that's been there since 1947, which essentially followed the Nehruvian model of democracy and of development. Now, it may come as a surprise to many people here that after 1947, after the British left, the entire structure of colonial British law remained in India, and the entire structure of British colonial administration remained in India. Now, we talk of British law in very laudatory terms, and certainly British law in Britain is a wonderful construct. I mean, more than 1,000 years ago, you had the Magna Carta, you had that the contribution of that island to human freedom is immense. But British law for colonial subjects was slightly different from British law for British people, or British law in the dominions like Canada, Australia, etc. It was designed to ensure that the government had near total control over most aspects of individual life and behavior. So you had multiple agencies, and each of these agencies had severe penal powers. Each of these agencies had immense discretion to get into the lives of citizens, get into the activities of citizens, and create problems for them. It was fortunate for India that during the Second World War, Britain needed industry. It needed defense products from wherever it got them. So the policy of trying to prevent domestic manufacturers from coming, from being suppressed, was changed during wartime, and domestic manufacturing got a huge boost. With the result, and this may surprise you, private industry in India in 1947 was significantly more larger than, of course, than Japanese industry or Korean industry or any other private industry group in Japan or in much of Europe. You had the Tatas, you had the Birlas, you had so many industrial groups that by world standards were pretty high up. Unfortunately, retaining the structure of colonial law and the Nehruvian model, which basically said government is on top. That is, we know what to do, and you guys should follow us. I mean, that's a colonial system. The colonial master knows what to do, and everybody's subjects will need to follow the master. The same system was continued. As a consequence, the private sector in India took a very hard knock. I'm happy to say my university was started in 1952. It's a private university. And it survived. It has survived all those years of extreme state regulation in India. If you go back to the Supreme Court files, if you go back to legal files, you'll find several cases in which Manipal is involved and which our university has fought, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully, against government use of discretionary power and against government control over our operations. So what I want to say is that there is a great perception about India as a democracy and about Nehru as a great democrat. And I would like to say that, in very large part, that is justified. But I'd also like to point out, he retained the entire structure of colonial law, that is law for colonial subjects. He retained the entire structure of colonial administration, including the titles. I mean, you had the district collector, collecting revenue. And even today, the main function of the government of India is the collection of revenue, no matter how it's done. And more importantly, so far as foreign policy is concerned, so far as domestic economic policy was concerned, now normally what happens in a country, you consult various stakeholders. You'd consult corporates, you'd consult business groups, you'd consult civil society, you'd consult various groups and then formulate a foreign policy or an industrial policy because it affects everybody. Prime Minister Nehru, and I think I'm not revealing a secret when I say this, he basically consulted one person, that was himself and a few of his close friends whom he knew agreed with his way of thinking, and created a foreign policy and created an industrial policy which for a long time afterwards, because after all, the government was supreme. Till today, very few people have cared to examine how India's foreign policy post-war was created, except to say it's a Nehruvian policy, which basically means to decide it by one man. Now, I'm not a political scientist, but I do believe that democracy means consulting more than one person. You know, I may be completely wrong when I say this, but this has been a belief of mine for some time, that's what it means. But what I'm trying to say is that Narendra Modi represents a break from that Nehruvian past. Till his coming to power, every single politician has, including in his own BJP, has retained the Nehruvian system because of the immense power it gives the political class and the bureaucracy. So instead of having the British as the colonial, the last word, the elected political class becomes the last word. And they have total power over the bureaucracy and through the bureaucracy over the lives of citizens. I'll give you a simple example about the Indian Police Act. I don't know if you're aware that this is 2014. The Indian police are still governed by an act that was passed by the British in 1862. Now, I think 1862 is a long way back. It's so long back that even I wasn't born at that time, you know. But this act was after the what we call the First War of Independence, what the British call the Mutiny of 1857, and it was suffused with a desire to have total control over the police force. As a result, the political master, the Home Minister, the Chief Minister, has complete control over his police force, with the result that the average length of stay of a district superintendent of police, and in India, the fundamental, the most important unit of administration is the district. The district superintendent of police in India, the average is about 6.5 months remaining in a district. So Indian districts are fairly complex. I mean, it's not, you know, it needs, I would say, at least a year to understand the situation there. But before you're there, you're out and transferred somewhere else because some minister doesn't like some decision that you took. You can take 98 decisions that the minister likes. You're in good shape. The 99 decision is enough to get you transferred. Unfortunately, a lot of policemen were not smart enough to understand that 100 decision or the 99 decision, and they got transferred. What I'm trying to say is that this is frankly, you have a democratic constitution and you have laws which are colonial. You have a style of governance that is colonial and which gives immense authority to the state. And more importantly, vis-a-vis the state government, that is what, you know, what here you would call the provinces, well, what we call the states, immense authority to the central government. I was telling Keith that, and I mean, these, I have to be in Delhi about 2 days or 3 days a week. Whenever I land in that city, I feel I'm entering into my colonial master, because the rest of the country, frankly, I mean, is almost colonized by Delhi. Almost every single decision that affects them has to be first cleared in Delhi, with the result that the 5-star, 4-star, 3-star, 7-star hotels there do very, very good work, because a lot of people are coming just to get some bureaucrat to give some decision about a project which frankly should not even be at the state level. A Chinese mayor has more power than the chief minister of a state in India. The mayor of a Chinese town has much more power than the chief minister of a state in India. And the chief minister, remember, is sometimes elected by an electorate of 70 to 80 million people voting, as for example, the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh. Now, I'm not sure that that's entirely the best system to follow, but it's been followed for a long time, and it's been seen as a great system. It's been seen as a great adornment of democracy. And Prime Minister Nehru has also been treated in an extremely friendly way by, I would say, historians, the media, etc. And those of us who have been pointing this out, about 20 years ago, we were considered way out of line. These days, we're not yet mainstream, but we're getting there. Anyway, certainly we have, I think, a system of governance now headed by an individual who is not among those who believe that Nehru was essentially the most perfect person, the most perfect leader to lead this country. So that's the point I would like to make, that when we talk about a democracy in India, it's a democracy based on rules that were formulated before democracy came into India, based on rules that were designed to keep people in a tight state of control, which worked for a small elite, and which is now again being used to work for a small elite, and which is why a lot of distortions are there in India, in the politics, in the economics, in foreign policy, and in various other ways. That's as a small bit of introduction to why people like me believe Mr. Modi is important. The reason why he... But let me, say that a little bit about our election campaign. In 2011, it was very clear that this was going to be a presidential style of election. It was going to be a presidential campaign between Narendra Modi and Rahul Gandhi. It's another matter that Rahul Gandhi decided not to really fight very openly, but he held back. But it was a presidential campaign, and it was fought for the first time, I would say, on the basis of a clear ideology of governance. Now, a lot of reports have come about ideology of left and right, ideology of, you know, of one religion versus the other. I don't think that any of this is true as much as it was an ideology of governance. For the Congress Party under the Gandhi family, and let me remind you that in India, our democracy, most political parties are in effect owned by a family or an individual. There are some parties that, in Tamil Nadu, for example, that are owned by an individual. That's even better, the sole proprietorship. There are some, but most parties are owned by families. You've got the Congress Party, which is owned by the Gandhi family. You've got the Samajwadi Party, which is owned by, it's a long list, and if you Google, you can get all the names in that list. It's not a problem. So again, some of us believe this may not entirely be democratic, that you have a system in which the voter has got to choose between the servant of one political master and or the servant of another political master. So basically, my choice as a voter is to choose among 10 people, 10 political people who run political parties in India, whose yes man or yes person I have to vote from. The point was, that is the Congress system. Now, BJP fortunately is different. You have transformations there. You had a very strong hold of Advani and Vajpayee. Mr. Vajpayee is still around, but he is retired. Mr. Advani tried very hard to become the prime ministerial candidate. almost the entire central leadership of the BJP was with him, but there was a rank and file revolt, so to speak, and Mr. Modi was anointed the prime ministerial candidate. It's no secret that if the Delhi-based leadership had its way, Mr. Modi would not have been its candidate. He has become the candidate because of grassroots support. The same kind of grassroots support that in the Democratic Party, for example, you had the Kennedys go and be replaced by the Clintons. You had the Clintons go and be replaced by Barack Obama. I mean, I'm not sure what's going to come next, but I'm not among those who believe it's inevitable that Hillary Clinton is going to come back as the next president of the United States. But I'd like to say that in that sense, the BJP has been different. You got a person who, frankly, was not popular among the central leaders of his party, coming and taking up a leadership position in it purely because of the rank and file pressure. In Indian politics, this is fairly unprecedented. It happens in other democracies very frequently, but in India, it's extremely unprecedented. Now, that's point one. Second point is, the Congress Party, or Mr. Rahul Gandhi, let's put it that way, says, Dole, I'll give you this much of money. I'll give you 100 rupees, I'll give you 50 rupees, I'll give you 200 rupees. The Modi says, talks in terms of empowerment, that you'll create systems that promote growth, that create systems in which you grow yourself. So the government is not going to give you anything. The government is going to remove obstacles to you giving yourself a much better life. So in that sense, instead of a culture of dependency, you try and create a culture of aspirations, that you aspire for a better future, for a better life in your own country. For a long time, unfortunately, a situation has been there in which we, the people of India, can aspire for a better life, but only if we migrate to other countries. You know, I see a lot of my friends here who have migrated, and I'd like to say that, you know, I respect them all. But I would like to say that it's much better for me if I see that in my own country an Indian can do better and doesn't need to migrate to any other country. So the aspirational aspect has been targeted by the BJP as against this culture of dependency. And most importantly, a creation of a sense of insecurity. You're insecure because some other people of some other community do not like you. You're insecure because some big countries are opposed to you. You have this threat from some country or the other. It's always a constant playing up of insecurity. I think Keith will recognize some symptoms of American politics in that kind of creation of insecurity. I'm not going to mention any political parties because being from India, I mean, we are neutral. But on the contrary, Mr. Modi's pitch has been, be self-confident as an Indian. You have 1.26 billion people. You've got the youngest population in the world. You've got a population of fairly bright people. You've got all the systems in place except bad policy and bad governance to really make you grow faster. So let's be confident. Let's not be afraid to face the world. Let's not shut ourselves off from the rest of the world. Let's engage completely with the rest of the world, including what you think are danger zones for us. Why I'm saying this is a significant component of what I believe is going to be the evolving foreign policy of this particular government. Now, as I said, I mean, you know, I was telling Angie that as an Indian, for me, an average length of speech is about 4 hours. But Angie tells me that, you know, you have a slightly more restrictive policy. I may say so, almost a colonial policy on that. So I'll have to respect that colonial policy and cut it short. I just want to speak a little bit about the man. He comes from an extremely humble background. I don't know if I should be proud to say, we in Sunday Guardian are the first to give wide publicity to the fact that Narendra Modi comes from one of the most backward of backward castes. I mean, he's so backward that 200 years ago, if some other caste touched him, that person would have to take a bath for the next 3 months, every day, twice a day, to recover from that terrible, you know, shock of having touched somebody from that particular caste. The most backward of backward castes. Nothing, you societally, in terms of caste, economically, in terms of class, extremely, I mean, poorly endowed of money. And the interesting news is that the Modi family, even today, is a family which is economically certainly underprivileged. His mother lives in a two-room house. One of his brothers lives in another two-room house. They have not come up in life at all, even though their brother has been Chief Minister of Gujarat for nearly 13 years and is now the Prime Minister of the country. Now, I mean, in my other job as a politician, I mean, as a journalist, you know, or as an activist or whatever, I've come across a lot of people in politics. And I can tell you, I've never come across an individual who's a chief minister whose family is in that kind of condition. Normally, when you're high up in politics, by some miracle, your children become super bright, your wife becomes a tremendous expert in business and commerce and finance, you know, your nephew becomes superb in managing to get the best business deal around, and all of a sudden, before you know it, you're millionaires and billionaires. It's a miraculous transformation of office that takes place. But unfortunately for Mr. Modi's family, or I would say fortunately for my country, it has not taken place in his family. His family is still as poor as they were before he was the chief minister, and as poor as they were before he was the prime minister. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just pointing it out to show you the kind of person this gentleman is. Now, I don't know, it's well known that he spent, you know, soon his parents wanted him to get married. So he went ahead and agreed out of respect for the parents. From the marriage pandal itself, he left because he didn't want his mother and father to. He left his new wife and went to the Himalayas and spent several years there. The point about that, which is a point about his life which is hardly ever mentioned, is that this is a person who thinks, who's got very high aspirations, who really, you know, goes by that old Bhagavad Gita saying that you aim at the stars, even if you don't hit it, it's better than aiming at the moon and hitting the moon. This is a gentleman with immense reserves of self-confidence. I mean, some people would say that it's a problem, but he's got immense reserves of self-confidence in his country, in his people, and in himself. So he sets very difficult tasks, then he tries and goes about fulfilling those tasks. So that's a very important point about it. And this Himalayan Odyssey, I think, is proof of the fact that here's a guy who looks very far ahead, sets on a task very far ahead, and then tries to create a roadmap that works on those tasks. Which is why the personality of Narendra Modi was central in this entire campaign. People did not vote for his party. They voted for the man. And they voted for the man because they believed that he would create a kind of system that would finally unlock the energies of the Indian people. You see Indians across the world, they're doing very well. You see Indians in India, only a small handful are doing very well, the well-connected, the others are not. What is that miraculous basket of policies that can transform India into a situation where you can do as well in India as you can do, let's say, in Hong Kong or in any other part of the world? Now, before I came here, I had a discussion with my friends in the Hong Kong India Chamber of Commerce. Arun is a very old friend of mine, and I'm happy to say that I think a significant proportion of the Indian population of Hong Kong is here in this lunch. And I thank you, I mean, my brothers and sisters, for coming here. But I'd like to say that we had some talk about the Modi cabinet and the Modi budget. Now, I mean, have you heard about the Gujarat cabinet? Have you heard about the budgets in the state of Gujarat? I don't think so. In the Modi system of governance, a cabinet is important, definitely, but important to a degree. A budget is important, definitely, but important to a degree. And that degree is significantly less than their being decisive in policy making the way in other systems of governance, cabinets and budgets are going to be. The fact of the matter is, this is going to be a very presidential style of government. Early in his, you know, who comes as minister, the kind of budget is not so important as the day-to-day functioning of the government. And this is where an immediate difference has been created. For one thing, government officers have been told to come at 9 o'clock. If they come at 9:15, they get a memo warning them. That memo is not taken seriously, in 4 or 5 days, they may have a call from the Prime Minister himself, asking why, you know, what on earth is wrong with you? Do you have a problem at home? Is your child sick? I mean, is your wife, you know, being a little too nasty to you, or husband, as the case may be? Why are you so late? And I think after that, I can tell you they come at 8:30 every morning. They don't come at 9:15 or 9:30. They come at 8:30. So that's point one. Point two, he had a meeting with every single secretary to government, bypassing every minister. Now, this is an indication of the presidential style of functioning, because it's the secretaries who really take decisions. Now, in India, I'm sorry to say, how have decisions been taken over a long period of time? I'm not talking about the charming theories that we read in textbooks. I mean, as an academic, I rely on textbooks, but why I don't give too many lectures, I don't want to talk too much of utter rubbish to my students, which is the rubbish that I see in those textbooks. So I'm not allowed to speak beyond the textbooks, unfortunately, so I don't talk. But the way Indians are, the way decision-making is taken, a minister will look at, let's say there are 200 decisions to be taken. There'll be 6 or 7 decisions that are important to the minister, because, let's be honest, it enables the minister and his family, etc., to ensure that, you know, as that old song had it, what a wonderful day or something it is, you know, that this becomes a wonderful day after that decision. The other decisions, 194, oh, forget it. The secretary goes to secretary. Secretary may have about 20 decisions or one decision which involves him. His wife may have asked for something, some brother-in-law may have asked something else, some friend may have come, somebody may have come with a present, and you know, if a person is a generous person giving with a present, that person is by definition a good person. So the secretary, maybe 20. Those 20 decisions secretary will take. The remaining, I don't know, I'm bad in mathematics, but about 180 decisions are left lower levels. So lower level, until the last level, he may have one or two things and he takes. Now, in this situation, about half the decisions don't get taken because nobody has a personal interest in them. The whole problem in it, and those half may include the best decisions that need to be taken for the country. The decisions which brothers-in-law, sons-in-law, I mean, various other, you know, relatives, and I don't want any of my Indian friends to report that I am against the family here, for simple reason, because Indians are very proud of family, and so am I. Brothers-in-law, sons-in-law, they all have their place. But you know, you can't just take decisions based on what brothers-in-law like. So a lot of important decisions in India are held up for years and years and years because nobody is really interested in them. I'm not going to allege financial impropriety. It could be just good faith, whatever, but that's what happened. This gentleman itemizes every decision. He puts a timeline on them. If you look at the Sunday Guardian, we've carried a story about how he says every Thursday he wants the next Wednesday's cabinet, a draft note to be put up every Thursday for the next Wednesday's cabinet, because he wants that Wednesday's cabinet to take final decisions on every item that is in the cabinet. Every single item in the cabinet has to be decided in that cabinet, and very few should be allowed to be sent over to the next cabinet. And they have been basically given a timeline of 2 weeks to take these decisions. Now, 2 weeks may seem a lot, but in India, the average length of time for a government decision is 11 years. Now, 2 weeks is slightly shorter than 11 years, you know, as far as I can say. Now, why is this happening? It's happening because Narendra Modi, and I'd like to confess, I'm not a friend of his. I mean, if in a crowded room like this, if I were to be around, I'm not sure that he would recognize me. I'm not sure that I'd want to be recognized by him, but I'm not sure I'd be recognized by him. I'm not a friend of his, but I've studied him as an academic for quite some time. I've known him for about 16 years. And so I'm interested in his style of work, his style of functioning. This is a person who has come from a cadre system. And a cadre system is different from a normal political system. A normal political system is more like an NGO almost, although some NGOs do function like cadres. A cadre system is very task-oriented. A cadre system functions in a hostile environment. A cadre system is very timeline-oriented, because your success as a cadre depends on fulfilling targets on time. It fulfilling on getting targets from the top, fulfilling them on time. And it depends on managing a hostile environment. He has been a cadre worker of a very huge organization. He's got about 80, 90 million people, the RSS, for a long period of time. He's traveled across the country many times. He's seen a lot of things firsthand. And that has been what I think has conditioned him, is this cadre experience of Narendra Modi, which is very different from the personal experience. So I just want to end by saying, so far as foreign policy is concerned, in my view, for example, you know, this is Hong Kong, I'd like to talk about China. 2 minutes on China. I believe that the earlier government had a policy of basically avoiding contact with China in terms of industry, etc., while not really doing very much about the difficulties that it faced with China. My own belief is Mr. Modi is going to have a policy, a twin-track policy. One, talk to the Chinese in very friendly and frank terms about issues which concern India, such as, for example, their providing of nuclear assistance to Pakistan, such as, for example, the kind of missile assistance they are providing to Pakistan, which is not entirely sure of not launching a war in India. Other problems that we have, the defense minister, Mr. Arun Jaitley, went public to say there are, in a technical sense, no incursions by the Chinese side on the border. That's an extraordinary statement for an Indian defense minister to say in an atmosphere of jingoism. He said, our concept of the border is one, Chinese concept is different. Our troops go there, their troops come here because we don't have a defined border. It's important to have a defined border. The point is, India is now open for business so far as China is concerned. Narendra Modi's Gujarat was open for Chinese business throughout the years in which Chinese business was excluded from most of India. But at the same time, China will have to understand that this is an India that believes that it is entitled to its rightful place. Now we're going to have a BRICS meeting. There's going to be a discussion of a BRICS bank. It's not going to be agreeable to the Indian side if the BRICS bank is going to be another World Bank in which you have a dominant power, America, running the whole show, or another IMF in which Europe is the dominant group and runs the whole show. We can't have a BRICS bank in which one country is dominant. Certainly, one country can promote more, but there have to be systems in place, vetoes, for example, or enough representation on the board, enough representations on decision-making to ensure that decision-making gets taken in an equal way. Neither in the BRICS bank nor in terms of the military should, I think, China follow the United States or NATO model. NATO believes in the use of force. China should not. NATO believes it's got a divine right to come anywhere and interfere everywhere. I don't think that China should adopt the same policy. What I think that the new government will be hoping for is that China is going to remain wedded to the Chinese win-win concept rather than a zero-sum concept. The Chinese civilization has succeeded by the power of its civilization, not by the power of the sword. And when you see attempts to replicate NATO, when you see attempts to replicate the IMF and the World Bank in the functioning of a proposed BRICS bank, in our view, this does not represent Chinese culture, Chinese tradition, or indeed Chinese interests. So I think there's going to be a to and froing. But I, for one, am very optimistic about a very bright future for India and China under Prime Minister Modi and President Xi Jinping. Thank you.
I welcome questions from the audience. If you could tell us your name, where you're from, and we have a gentleman right over here. Thank you.
You're welcome to take it here or up here.
Professor, thanks for the great speech. I'm Adi from LIM Advisors. Just a couple of questions on the first point you mentioned about the centralization of power in India as an artifact of the British times. Just, I guess, tying it to today, Modi and his cabinet in Gujarat, Amit Shah especially, they were pretty renowned for centralizing power in the hands of like a few ministers around them at that time. And this was press commentary over time of the last 10 years or so in Gujarat. I guess one point will be, how does that tie into sort of making them different from, say, Congress or any of the Janata Dal guys before them?
You know, I'd like to say that, Prime Minister Modi is the first person to come after Devegowda, who was there for a very short time, right from the chief ministership to the prime ministership. So he's come from a province to the central level, and the second prime minister after Devegowda to become that. So far as his Gujarat thing is concerned, from what I've studied, I've been to Gujarat multiple times, I've studied his style of working, I can tell you that that centralization does not exist. He bypasses the higher levels and goes straight to the middle and lower levels, and he encourages the middle level to go to the lower level, higher level to go to lower levels. There's a lot of cutting through levels in his system.
and he uses the internet a lot. He uses video conferencing a lot. So you never know if that video terminal is going to come alive with his words and his face in front of you if you're an officer. At any time, the screen can come alive and the chief minister can talk directly to you. Now the prime minister can talk directly to you. He just drops in on secretaries, drops in on officers. I mean, he's gone to Brazil. He's taken officials with him. He's not taken ministers, he's taken officials. So I would not agree it's a centralized form. I wouldn't agree that some ministers were more powerful than other ministers, quite frankly. I don't think that is actually borne out by the reality on the ground. Although press reports, I do agree, gave that impression.
Question from Florence.
Thank you. I agree, it was a fascinating speech. The issue you mentioned most was governance and inherited from the colonial past. But one issue that is very often raised when people talk about India's trouble is the cost. And considering Mr. Modi's past, what do you think he's going to do about that?
You think cost or past?
Cost.
Cost.
The cost issue. Oh,
wonderful. I'm delighted you raised that. Because when we in Sunday Guardian went and outed the fact that he was the most backward of backward castes, I'm not sure even Mr. Modi was entirely happy with us. But this is the first time somebody from the backward caste has become the prime minister of the country. I mean, it's a Barack Obama moment, frankly. Barack Obama coming has given oxygen, has given confidence to millions of Americans that we can also make it. And you have a lot of talk about backwardness and backward caste, but these have been taught by people of a different caste altogether. This is the first person from the backward caste to become the prime minister. And I think that's a huge statement. I'm happy that people from so-called backward castes became chief ministers. That has created social transformation in India. It's still a work in progress. Caste is still a problem and a barrier to many things. But Prime Minister Modi represents the first time that a backward class person has become the prime minister of the country. You know, his point is very clear. You have to empower Indians in general, educate them in general, give them opportunities in general. Then don't talk in terms of caste, community, religion, etc. I'll give you a simple example about this Uniform Civil Code. Now, he's considered to be a Hindu fanatic because he favors a Uniform Civil Code. You have a Uniform Civil Code in the United States. You have it in France. You have it in Germany. You have it, if I'm not mistaken, in countries like Egypt, where everybody has the same civil rights as anybody else. Now, I don't think in France you're allowed to have more than, let's say, a particular number, one spouse. I don't think it's allowed legally. But you don't consider France uncivilized because of that. So a lot of the debate has been in Kashmir, for example. There are no theater movie houses in Kashmir. There's no alcohol in Kashmir. Now, why can't a Kashmiri go to movie house or alcohol? But if you say that Kashmiri should have movie house and alcohol, that immediately becomes an attack on fundamental rights. So I'm sorry to say, I think the Western people should learn to understand, we would like the same standards that you practice in your country. If you don't believe that a person should have more than one spouse, then there's nothing wrong if some of us believe the same. If you believe that movie houses are good and alcohol is good, there's nothing wrong if some of us believe it should be there. And wherever I travel in my country, including Kashmir, I should have the right to take that little glass of red wine, which I'm told by my doctor is good for my health.
Eric Floyd, FCC member, you talked about the colonial heritage and all the laws and regulations. Saying this man comes in and he has a whole different view of how to govern the country. But of course, before he was railing against all this from outside. Now, once he's in there and has all this government mechanism, it's all very well to say he's going to change it all, but maybe he'll find it useful to use what's already there. Is it possible he'll be transformed by the office he's in rather than transforming India?
No, Floyd, I'd like you to think that this is a country where huge change is taking place. It's taking place because of greater flow of information, greater access to the internet. It's a shame that we have the lowest internet speeds in Asia. It's a shame that there are less than 200 million people in India connected to the internet. It's a little more than 200 million more because of this mobile phone, but it's still very low. But the fact is, this is an amazing, technology is becoming an amazing vehicle for empowerment. Even if someone will want to bring that control back, it's not going to happen. He's not going to be able to do it. And he recognizes that. He's ahead of the curve. His rivals could not recognize that. For example, there's a big debate came about English. Several of the people in his own party, quite frankly, are people that you would not trust with running a small little bicycle shop. You know, they're absolutely people who should not be trusted even in the bicycle shop. And many of them said you should do away with English. Now the fact is, English is one of the few good things the British left behind in India. You know, and we are the largest English-speaking country in the world after the United States. In another 7 or 8 years, let me tell you, we're going to have more people in India speaking English than the United States. And with the rate of the growth of Spanish, I think it will be even faster. In another 16 or 17 years, there'll be more English-speaking Indians than people in Australia, Canada, US, New Zealand, and the UK combined. So they want to demolish it. This man, he kept quiet, but clearly indicated. Then a minister went and said, only Hindi. He's almost in an hour's time, the Prime Minister's office said, nothing doing. So my own point is, this is a man who's got a 60-month timeline. Please don't judge him by a 60-day timeline. Hopefully a 120-month timeline, but at least a 60-month timeline. It's going to be 11, 20, 30, 40, 50 months before you can really tell me that he's been a failure or a success.
Hi, Robin Meredith with Reorient. Two quick questions. You talked about him having a 60-month timeline, but of course, India is impatient for change. That's why they voted for him. So, first of all, a lot of the progress that was made in the last 5-10 years came because of devolution to the states for a lot of business decisions and power, including in Gujarat. Will that continue? And secondly, what can you tell from the budget that was just released last week about exactly what policy changes Modi's going to focus on first to make some progress?
The first point about devolution of power to the states, I haven't come across it. So possibly we are living in different worlds here, because I haven't come across any devolution. The centralizing has been very strong. But devolution, I think, is likely. Certain steps have been made. I'll give you a very simple example. If you want to give, let's say, apply for a passport, and you want to your school certificate, you have to get a government officer to sign there and then present to the government that this is accurate. Mr. Modi has said, nothing doing, we accept the citizen signature. If a citizen signs that this is really his school certificate, we accept that. And if it's not, there are ways of this, otherwise you have to go to a government officer who never knew you, who didn't know whether you were in school or college or whatever. You paid him a bribe and he did a signature. That's been changed. So slowly these things are happening. And if you look at the budget, the main point about the budget is, if you talk to your friends in India, the last 3 or 4 years, there've been raid after income tax raid on people in India. Raid after raid. Mr. Modi has given a very clear signal. Unless you've got very good reason, you better not raid a taxpayer. Treat the person in a civilized way. Let me tell you that the Indian Income Tax Act is one of the most barbaric in the world. You know, if the income tax officer has absolute discretion to say whether you evaded tax or not, and if you evade as little as $20, you can go to jail for 5 years. I mean, that's a totally barbaric act. And he has said, this is a barbaric act, but don't implement it. So slowly, I would say, if you come to India, you'll find among business community, you'll find among taxpayers, you'll find among professionals, a mood is slowly changing. It's not going to be easy. I agree he's going to face obstacles, but this is a man who has remained, whose family has remained poor, despite the fact that he's been in power in 14 years. His family has remained poor, he has remained poor. I don't think the man has any kind of money, anything beyond a house in Gujarat, which he took as a legislator, nothing more than that. I don't think he's suddenly going to change and start getting a yen for corruption and for bribes when he didn't show any sign of that in these 14 years.
I'm afraid we only have time for one more question, and I see a hand here, and if it can be a very quick question, and Professor Malapati.
I'm Joel Lakin, Secretary General of the IPPF. That stands for the Independent Power Producers Forum. You said a lot about power, P-O-W-E-R, you know, electricity. You mentioned shame, and the lady previous question, I couldn't resist bringing this up, said, what big issue will the Modi regime attack first? I want to draw a quick comparison. The world's largest totalitarian dictatorship has over 1,100,000 megawatts. India's got the same population, staggering with only 240,000 megawatts. What's going to happen? Will the doors be thrown open for all those multinationals that want to come in and help India provide good, clean power for its masses, because they can't get into China, because they blow to the dice for the big five?
Well, I know I don't represent the government in any way, but my sense would be the answer would be a yes. And I'd like to point out that if you look at the Sunday Guardian, I've written some, my last three, four reports, as in the front page, Madhav Nalapat, have basically been about NGOs that block this kind of energy projects in the country and how they're holding back important power generation. The main problem we face, we have 15 million young people joining the job market every day. That's a bit more than the population of, I think, Australia, I mean, all about the same. We have to create more jobs. You can't do that unless you produce power. There have to be some give and take between various factors. And we had a problem in which we had no coal was not being mined, power was not being produced. We had multiple bottlenecks, which I expect will be cleared. The reason is Mr. Modi is fundamentally a politician. He wants his 120 months in office. And he's not going to get his 120 months unless he delivers in the first 60 months. He's not going to deliver unless he can get enough power for the country.
With that, Professor Nalapat, we want to thank you on behalf of FCC, a little present of our gratitude. Florence, if you could do the presentation. And he's got 60 months. You say give the man 50 before you decide. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for joining. Have a great afternoon. Thank you.